This is a podcast from wingsatliberty.com. Check out the wingsatliberty.com website, where you will find more information about issues related to flying birds, learning to train birds, and events offering experiences with flighted birds. This podcast is a free service supported by the folks at organicbirdfood.com, makers of Foundation Formula Pellets, Dynamo Sprout Mixes, and Merry Medley Seed Mixes. That's www.organicbirdfood.com. Please show your support by visiting organicbirdfood.com.
This is Alternate Perspective, a Wings at Liberty podcast where we discuss issues related to free-flying birds. I'm Chris Spiro, and today I'm joined by bird fancier and author Dorothy Schwartz.
It is now on. All right. I'm Chris Spiro. I'm sitting here with Dot Schwartz, and we're in Moab, and we're going to discuss Dot's visit here with us at Porcupine Ranch. Dot, why don't you tell us a little bit about where you come from and what brings you here?
Okay. I come from Colchester, England, and I've been involved with parrots increasingly for the last 10 years. And for 9 of those years, I've been on Chris Spiro's free flight list, which is a bit, I suppose, how do you say it? It's a bit of a paradox because I don't free fly my birds. However, they're all flighted, and I'm very interested in free flight. I'm a working writer. I write for quite a lot of UK and Australian avian magazines, and hope to write about this experience. It's one of those experiences which don't really, you can't really describe it. I'll try and give you the view. We're on a little hill slightly above Porcupine Ranch, which is hidden about 300 metres below us in some trees. And we have a 360-degree view. I don't know who is listening to this, where you live, but a 360-degree view is not something you see every day. The valley is well wooded, green, and all surrounding it are these pink sandstone and granite mountains. And right in the middle, really put there like a stage set, is what you call Fisher Rocks, isn't it?
That is actually Castle Rock.
Castle Rock. So it is actually, if Chris had said to me, well, actually, it's a very, very old castle in ruins, I would be tended to believe him because it looks like the keep tower and the main tower, and the rest of it is, you know, where the people would have gone in. But actually, it is not man-made. It is a natural foundation.
I'll go ahead and put a photo from this view on the website where the podcast is at so people can see this view. That Castle Rock is actually in Mission Impossible 2 at the beginning, where Tom Cruise is climbing on a big rock, and that's the rock that Tom Cruise is on.
But from my point of view, spectacular and beautiful as this is, there's something far more beautiful. About 3 meters away from us is a dead tree, and sitting in that dead tree are 3 macaws. They're just browsing, not even interested in us. And this is now 9 o'clock, and I've been here for a week, and Chris has given me the enormous privilege of letting the macaws out in the morning. The macaws are brought into the house where they have very ample cages, and which are provided with kibble and water. So these are not hungry birds. And first person up, which in the Mopukam Ranch at the moment is me, opens the cages, tells the birds to step up, which they all do impeccably, walks out of the front door, and then just stands there. The calicos seem to be the most lively in that sense. They just go off with a huge squawk. 4 calicos. There are 2 blue throats. I'm only ever having seen blue throats in zoos or you know, pictures of them in the wild. Here are blue throats living as, I don't know how you would describe them. They're not pets, they're not show birds. They're not semi-feral parrots, and they are all three together. I mean, you can actually pet these birds. Chris takes them in shows, and when they're out, they are looking out for themselves. It's very moving. It's a very moving experience.
I wouldn't say that they don't have any interest in us, because the reason they're sitting in that tree is because you and I are sitting up here on the hill.
Yes.
Otherwise, they'd be down in the trees below us. Mm. So they have some interest in us because they are curious about what we're doing, and they do like to be with us. And if they thought for a moment that they could come down here and get a peanut out of me, they'd be down here.
One of the things about Chris and Susan, his partner, that you might criticize or admire, they're quite casual about the birds. And Chris said, I said, can I try some of my little training with them? Sure, no problem. There's no great rules. They clicker train, which I don't, and I think within a day I got one of the blue throats to wave, and by the end of that day the second blue throat would wave, and then I think two of the calicos would wave. And I suppose one of the most thrilling moments of my life, and I'm in my 70s now, would be to have two blue throats sitting on my hand and both waving in unison. Unfortunately, the moment when they did that, Chris wasn't there and Susan wasn't there and Janet wasn't there, but I think they believe me that I'm not lying.
I do believe you.
So that aspect of it is quite magnificent. I mean, I think people would get different things from this place. I mean, some people would just be blown away by the view. Other people would be blown away by seeing birds at liberty. Another high point of my visit was Janet Jean-Pierre from Virgin Islands was also one of these house guests, and she actually brought a bird to fly, and I saw her blue throat. First day, she says, oh, my blue throat doesn't fly with my macaws at home. She's ditzy. But within a day, she had flocked with the two other blue throats, who may be two females or maybe a male and a female. It's part of Chris's casualness. He hasn't even checked that out yet. And these three blue throats were flying with synchronized flying. If you were trying to train that, God knows how you would do it, but it was rather like watching three aircraft in an aircraft show. Wings out together, wings down together, and they wheeled. We weren't actually at the property. We'd gone to some horrendous rock where they just scamper about, the Chris and Susan scamper about like goats, and Janet and I go on our hands and knees. But they say, oh, no, it's fine, it's fine. And, of course, as my husband said on the phone when I said, oh, we're taking these birds to a canyon, he said, birds can fly.
Yeah, the birds aren't worried about falling.
Yeah, so that was a great high spot to watch Janet's blue throat flocking within a period of 24 hours with the other two blue throats.
Now, we didn't just start out by going straight to that canyon. We first started out by going to some wide open spaces and introduced Hannah to flying in a very careful way. We didn't just take him up to the top of Fisher Overlook where the dinosaur tracks were there and that big cliff. Mm-hmm. We never did fly Hannah there at the cliff. That would have been more than Hannah was ready for. That's a level 5 location. But Hannah flew quite nicely at level 3 and level 4 locations, starting out at level 1, where it's wide open. So it was quite fun. I very much enjoyed that as well. So what do you think about your own interest in free flight? Because I know you've had some interest in flying grays and so forth. Have you experienced anything here that would give you a different perception of what's available for ways to fly birds, or what's possible with birds? How does that impact your having been here? How does that impact your interest in flying?
It makes me realize that in the environment which I live, which is full of villages, which are full of human predators, I would be very reluctant to have my greys fly out of my sight, because they have flown out of my sight, they have gone down to people in the villages, and those people have returned them to me. but it's not a certainty.
Right.
The hawk, the predator problem here, they seem to solve rather well. The birds here, I've noticed when they see a predator, there are hawks or ravens, they all shriek and they're in a big flock, and they're big birds. I would be very nervous in an English setting to let a timna out, although I did have a free-flying timna, with the amount of hawks we have and owls. What has impressed me is the physical seeing of something I saw on YouTube and on Chris Byrow's list, is that they did document fairly fully how they brought up Buckle, a hand-fed baby, and then flew Buckle. Buckle is now part of the flying team, and you wouldn't believe, how old is she?
Oh, Buckle's, just over a year.
Yes, well, you would not believe to see this bird fly, that this is a year-old bird. It flies with the others, and it's still a pet, because what I thought one of the funniest things that happened on the trip was Susan had finished, or Chris had finished hand-feeding a couple of baby sonconures who were still in the brooder, and he'd mixed too much mixture, left it on the kitchen sink. I'm a rather careless person. I left the door open, the main door into the patio, and looked up and saw a large shamrock macaw waddling indoors, waddling into the kitchen, jumping up to the sink and scoffing the rest of the baby's food.
She does still like to be hand-fed very much.
The other thing that totally impressed me, only having seen macaws who were show macaws, who you can work with, at another training place I went, but are not in any way considered to be people-friendly. They don't bite, but you don't pet them. These macaws, who just fly around as if they were in the wild, will also come to you and do behaviours or sit on your lap or whatever you want. I don't know, should I admit this in public, but I was actually kissing my macaw because I just thought she was the most lovely thing I ever saw. And then she'd had enough of being kissed by elderly foreigners, and off she flew. It's fantastic, and I do hope that Chris and Susan make this sort of opportunity available to other people. It is quite, I suppose it's quite unique. I mean, there must be people around who have flocks of birds living in this way. I know of one in UK, an elderly man who has a flock of free-flying parrots, a few of whom are tame, but most of them are free-flying, and they come back every evening to roost outside his house. But this particular thing is quite spectacular, is the ability of these birds to conduct themselves in what Chris says is very environments going from level 1 to 5, conduct themselves very well and yet still be handleable in every single way you could possibly imagine.
We've had a lot of fun with them, and we enjoy our birds, not just because of the flying that we do, but we enjoy them because of the relationship that we can have with them. And I get the impression that they enjoy the relationship they have with us, as well as the flying that we do when we go to different places.
Well, you know, there's a lot about, you know, you don't know what a bird thinks, you only know what it does. And the first time we took the birds up on one of these impossible mountains, Janet and I, as I say, crawling on our hands and knees, I was not entirely convinced that the birds enjoyed it. But the second time I saw them, the birds were flying, and then they came back to the rock where we were, and they were, I can only use the word playing, they were playing with us. Now, I cannot think that birds who, I mean, I've seen birds, I'm not a great expert, but I know body language, and the body language of these birds was constantly relaxed. I've seen them actually at Porcupine Ranch not being relaxed, and then Chris has said there is a predator around and that's what they're doing. So I have to say that my initial impression, I'm now changing that, and I think they do like this sort of flying. Now, that sort of flying, I think, even if I managed to free fly my birds, would not be within my gut level, courage level.
Sure.
I wouldn't be able to do it, which doesn't mean I can't admire it. And I think there probably are quite a few people who would be in the gut level who could do it.
Well, you saw Janet come here with her bird, who's got some good skills. We brought Dave and Jamie out here with an African Grey, a young African Grey, and within a few days had that African Grey flying at level 4 locations. So seeming to have a good time as well. So it's possible that there are, you know, we've now demonstrated with both young birds and adult birds. Now, the adult bird we're talking about was a bird that could fly. And had good flight skills because of where Janet flies the bird in the Virgin Islands. Is got a lot of wind and so forth. So, and she's flying with some other macaws. So that bird had a fairly advanced level in the first place. But still, being comfortable, the bird had to get comfortable here and seemed to relax pretty well. So I think that there are people out there that might enjoy this. Certainly the opportunity is we are developing the opportunity for people to do that as we get ready. We have so much to learn from this as well. We're by no means masters of this environment yet. We are certainly enjoying the process of learning about this environment.
I think another thing that struck me a lot, my dream would be to be in my garden in Essex in England with some of my birds with me. I think possibly if I ever could start a bird, as I saw Janet start Buckle, that might be possible. And what I was almost moved to tears by Friday afternoon when the macaws were out. I think 8 macaws. Janet had already put her bird ready for travelling. It was in a case of 8 macaws just hanging around the property. And Susan and Chris have brought up a flock of 11 sun conures. I think they've done this because of Chris's show. All these birds do the dollar bill trick. Somebody holds up a dollar bill in the audience and the bird flies with the dollar bill back to the stage and drops it in a vase. So it's very spectacular, and they're also quite friendly with the public. These are little tiny birds. I mean, they're not much bigger than sparrows. And I think at Porcupine Branch, they let them out in the afternoon fairly frequently. And so these little sun conures were flying about like little rays of sunlight and bathing in a water dish, sometimes with a macaw. And to see a macaw and a sun conure bathing is really quite funny. And I had a really funny experience of getting very excited about with my 2 blue throats on my hand, trying to get them to wave, and being literally buzzed by 3 or 4 sun conures. And I got to the point where I said, oh, you mustn't ever do anything aversive with a bird, of actually shrugging the sun conures off, because they were really a pest. I mean, but, you know, they don't mind, they just fly back and sort of, they were hanging out. They were just hanging out, and they were having fun. Now, I do think that aspect could be repeated by other people. I think small flocks of birds could, in fact, enjoy a great deal more liberty than they have without this extreme example that Chris and Susan give. I mean, I think they're the absolute extreme, but what I take away is the fact that one can say, well, look, here is an extreme, but there could be modifications. And they both do their training, as far as I can see, by what are now more and more considered to be the correct way of doing it, with positive reinforcement. They do no weight management, and they do very little food management. And yet, as far as I can see, it seems to work. You know, the birds don't come down instantly every time, but then I don't think birds ever do anywhere. I've never seen. And as I say, these are not hungry birds. The birds that macaws go out in the morning, having had a full dish the night before at Porcupine Ranch, and about an hour and a half later, you can cool them down and do what you like with them. And I've been teaching them sort of silly behavior tricks, and it's been one of the greatest thrills of my whole life.
Well, I'm glad you've enjoyed it. We've had fun having you here as well. It's been fun watching you work with the macaws and even the conures. It was quite fun watching them with you yesterday, where you were just kind of covered with little yellow sun conures as you were trying to work with Gleam and Dreadful. It's really been a lot of fun for us as well. We love having people out here and letting them see and get to meet and experience the personality of the birds. Because I think the personality is something that comes through when you have this kind of a relationship that you don't always see when a bird is on a weight management kind of a structure.
Well, the sun is still shining on this valley, but the macaws have gone away. And I'm rather hoping Chris will end the interview quite soon, because I can go back to the ranch and see if I can get them down. For anyone who's got free flighted out of door birds, I mean, the idea of training birds out of doors when the bird doesn't want to do it and just flies away, to me is the height of exciting training. And you really know that bird wants to be with you. And you also know, as I found out here, that the bird wants to be with me. Because I know it's not particularly hungry. It hasn't got sunflower seeds and peanuts in its food. They're fed on a high-quality kibble, but they're fed as much as they want. And so they're coming for treats, and they're coming because they want to. And personally, that to me, you know, gave me a lump in my throat. The only disagreement I have had, Chris has got a lot of birds, and he has birds he uses in his show for petting, and these are quite relaxed, unbiting birds, but he considers that for his show he has to clip them. And as you know, I'm very much in the anti-clipping brigade, so we've had some fairly strong arguments about that when he says he believes...
I wouldn't call them arguments, I'd call them discussions.
Yes.
And I'm more open to clipping than you are.
Lively discussions.
I honestly believe that a bird needs to be fully trained or clipped. And I'm not, I don't have a strong, what would I say? I'm not black and white on the issue of clipping and flying. I believe there are appropriate times for clipping. And in some cases, I believe it's appropriate to clip birds for our purposes. Even if the bird maybe could be a good flyer. Just like we put saddles on horses and bridles on horses for our purposes. That's not something that they generally want themselves. So there are trade-offs that we make to meet our objectives. And one of my objectives with my show is that the general public gets to meet and hold some of my birds. And they get to see somebody sit throughout the entire show holding a very friendly bird. And I value that, and I value it enough to take a bird who's just recently given to me, been clipped all his life, and I will continue to work with Sunday, a sulfur-crested cockatoo, a male sulfur-crested cockatoo, and it may be that at some point I change his role from being a pet bird, a petting bird in the show, to a flighted bird in the show. But at this point, the plan at the moment is to see how he progresses, but we will keep him in that role for this time being.
Yes, well, that was something I strongly didn't accept, but as I feel that what Chris Byer is doing is like an example to other people, even if people don't do that, but to see the idea that birds can have large amounts of liberty and still be... comparatively risk-free. I mean, I don't think Chris has lost birds, not at the property, but he has lost them in the shows, to things like electrocution. I think he has lost one on the property to a windmill. For me, those sort of risks are no greater than your clipped indoor bird who falls down the lavatory and drowns or gets aspergillosis or fatty liver disease because it never moves. And I should think probably if anyone collected the statistics, you would probably find that accidents of birds outdoors are fairly similar to accidents of birds indoors. And you've only got to see the demeanor of these outdoor birds to see the benefits of that. You know, their curiosity, their alertness, their general... whereas to me, the clipped bird sitting in a cage, it always looks... doesn't sort of look, it's not curious. And often in the case of greys, they get quite phobic because they can't fly, they can't get away, so they get phobic. There are no phobic birds on Porcupine Ranch.
No, they're not. And, you know, the risk factor, that's something each one of us has to come to terms with ourselves. For me, I have the belief that when I let these birds fly, yes, I add some additional risk, but at the same time, I'm taking away some risk that the clipped bird has that my birds now don't have. So there are trade-offs. There's trade-offs with everything. And I strive for balance. And for me, the balance includes... fully training them. Hi, Gracie. I have a calico macaw just flew up and landed on my shoulder. Going over to Dot.
No, she doesn't want to come to me. She'd rather be with her prime person.
Have you got a rock? Did you bring a rock to me, huh? Anyway, It, for me, once I take and bring the birds outside, I'm not very comfortable with partially training birds to fly. I believe that they need to have their full complement of skills, full physical fitness, all their feathers. I don't believe in partial clipping and flying them partially clipped, because some of the risks that they do face are very serious, and they need every advantage possible. Yeah. So. It's one of the reasons why I take them and fly them in some of their locations that I do, to build up their skill level for navigation, for physical fitness, for dealing with drafts of wind and air currents and so forth, on a level that gives them the highest potential of success if they face a predator or so forth.
The other thing that strikes me here is that the birds fly as a flock. The conures are a flock, the calicos are a flock, the sun throat, the blue throats are a little flock. I do really think that flying the lone bird is a much riskier business.
I agree.
Both from what I've read and learned and from what I've actually seen.
Well, that's why we have the flock of sun conures. Is what we wanted were more eyes in the sky to spot those predators before they show up and surprise the bird. The more birds you have out there flying with them, the more chance there is of somebody seeing it, and therefore the safety factor goes up, which is why they fly in flocks like that in the wild. Is it gives them a sense of security in numbers.
Well, I should be going home tomorrow and literally having doubled, tripled, quadrupled my understanding of flighted birds, and you know, feeling very, very reluctantly. It's not for me. It's still something that I would advocate for anyone with space and time and attitude.
Right, there's a lifestyle that goes along
with
this. There's
a
lifestyle that goes along with this. And not everybody's lifestyle is going to let them do this. Bye, Grace.
I think the idea of oh, well, my bird can fly, open the door and it'll fly and it loves me and it will come back to me, which has happened,
is
very wrong thing to do.
It's a very dangerous thing to do.
But I do think the aviary, the indoor hall, I mean, there are people on those free flight lists who have small birds and don't want to take them outside but take them regularly to a large hall where those birds do fly.
I think that's wonderful. And even that may be that for some people that's as much as they can do, and that's, I think that's wonderful. It may be that that's a stepping stone for them to take the next step to something like what we're doing here. But, you know, each person has to evaluate their own situation, their own mentality, their own personality, their own training skills, and their own environment. And I think it's wrong to judge people like some people I have done in the list to... for doing less than what they do. I think people need to be more open to allowing people to grow. We don't all start out as masters of anything. We always start out at the bottom and we learn our way up. to different levels. I think people need the latitude to be in a process of growth.
Yes.
And I think that's lacking out there to some degree.
Yes. Well, all I can say is thank you very much for giving me the chance not only to see your birds, but to work with your birds. Listen very carefully to what you said about speed of timing with offering the reward.
With training, timing is very important.
Maybe we'll be a better trainer when I get back home.
I would highly encourage you to use that clicker. Learn to use the clicker. Master the ability to handle it, because timing is very important when you want to teach a precise behavior.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, Dot, thank you for sitting here with us. I've really enjoyed this interview, and I've enjoyed having you with us. And I hope we get to have you back sometime.
Gosh, just ask.
All right. If you have questions or comments about something you heard during this podcast, please contact me through the Wings at Liberty website. That is www.wingsatliberty.com.
Special thanks to Dorothy Schwartz for coming all the way from the UK. Thanks to Benjamin Smith for his help with our audio. Thanks to Susan Hilliard for her overall support. I'm Chris Spiro, and thanks for joining us.
This has been a podcast from wingsatliberty.com. This podcast was produced by Chris Spiro, all rights reserved.